Hi, I'm Eric Umansky. Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I am an editor here at ProPublica, and I am here with Seth Fried Wessler, who is a contributor to ProPublica. And Seth, do you want to tell us who you are?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. I'm a reporter based here in New York. I write for NBCNews.com on poverty and inequality issues, write about the safety net and child welfare.
And Seth has written a great story for us, for those who haven't read it yet, about parents who have been diagnosed with some form of mental illness and lose their children as a result, essentially, of the diagnosis, even in the absence of any harm or neglect or any substantive evidence that they can't parent. Seth, you want to talk a little bit more about the story? Is that a fair overview that I've given of the story?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I got into this story because I'd reported for a number of years on child welfare issues. And I would hear people, lawyers and caseworkers, say things to me like, yeah, you know, that mother's never going to get her kid back because she's crazy. Or, you know, she has bipolar disorder, so she's not going to get her kid back. And it got me wondering. I would hear these comments over and over again. It got me wondering, what do you mean? What do you mean that bipolar disorder or, you know, severe depression mean you can't get your kid back? So I started digging around. And what I found was that there's actually a lot of concern that mental illness and bias about mental illness, the stigma of mental illness, is getting in the way of mothers and fathers getting their children back after they're removed by local child welfare authorities.
When, you know, you sort of think about it very briefly, you can think, well, you know, if somebody has bipolar disorder, are they in a position to be a parent and to capably raise a child?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's clear is that it really depends. Certainly there are people whose mental illness, whose bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, other mental health diagnoses make them incapable of taking care of themselves and incapable of caring for a kid, even occasionally make them potentially dangerous. But the reality is that when you look at the cases in practice, when you look at how these cases are dealt with by local child welfare authorities, oftentimes people are being treated on the basis of their diagnosis, not on the basis of any actual behavior, not because they've actually harmed
their kids. By treated, I'm sorry, what you mean is treated as in treated with by child services and having their children taken away.
Taken from them, and then beyond taken away, child protective services are filing in courts to terminate parents' rights to their kids, to legally sever parents from their children. And sometimes these kids end up being put up for adoption.
Yeah. One of the cases that we focus on in the story is the case of a young woman named Mindy. You want to sort of just give an overview of that case?
Yeah, sure. So Mindy was a new mom in her mid-20s living in Kansas, and she was pretty depressed and struggling, and she describes her living situation as not a very good one. And her mental health was deteriorating. And when her daughter was about 5 months old, she had this mental health crisis. She thought that her five-month-old had been raped, and she took her daughter to the hospital, absolutely petrified that something had happened. And it turns out that there was no evidence that anything had happened to her daughter, that she was having a psychotic break.
Was that and, labeled a, eventually diagnosed as postpartum psychosis?
That's right. One of the evaluators appointed by a court to evaluate her mental health said that she had something called postpartum psychosis, which is a relatively rare mental health condition that that for her flared up in this real fear about harm to her daughter. And at that point, the doctors or nurses called child protective officials in Missouri, where she'd taken her kid, and probably appropriately, her daughter was removed and placed in foster care because at the time she was pretty unstable. But what ended up happening is that local officials never gave her daughter back. And though she got treatment and recovered and really rebounded, Mindy was never able to get her children back, or her daughter back, rather. One of the most telling things in this story, though, is that, you know, Mindy had another kid. She had a son after she lost her daughter, and she was raising that son
in a different state.
In a different state, just over the border from Missouri, where she had been living in Kansas. And that state, you know, initially took this boy from the hospital because they were worried, you know, knowing what had happened in Missouri. But they found absolutely no evidence that she posed any risk to her son. And so they quickly returned him to his mom. And Jace, her son, is now living with her in a house in Missouri, where he's being raised, you know, happily and healthfully. And yet, she's lost her parental rights to her daughter.
And that's a concept that's sometimes called, and we describe it in the story, and it is a really sort of striking name for it, called predictive neglect.
That's right. Yeah. In at least one state, courts and child welfare departments refer to what this sort of legal standard as predictive neglect. This idea that you can predict future neglectful behavior or future violence toward a child based on certain conditions in the present or past behavior. In this case, too often that prediction is being made on the basis of somebody's diagnosis and past mental health history rather than on their present circumstances, their present ability to take care of their kids. You know, the laws sometimes say that this parent is unable for the foreseeable future to take care of their children, but it's often not clear that that's actually the case, that often past records of hospitalizations for mental health crises or a really scary event like the one that Mindy went through are used to keep children from their parents forever.
There are a couple of striking things, and one of them is that in other cases involving parents who are struggling or other sort of circumstances, states are typically required to provide help, right? So if you're a parent who is struggling with drugs, right, states are required to provide some services and to help you with your addiction, but that mental health is often or sometimes carved out as a kind of category where you don't have to do that.
That's right. There's two things happening here. There are actually six states where if a parent is deemed by a psychological professional to be seriously mentally ill to the point that it might get in the way of their parenting, local child welfare officials actually don't have to try to reunify that family, provide that parent with services so that they can...
With any help.
With any help at all. And so in one case I wrote about, case of a guy named Rudy, it was determined really early by local child welfare officials that he just wasn't going to be allowed to take his daughter home. And they never offered him any help to move to a house where he could raise her, to provide him with supports as a parent. And they've said that in court, that they were under no obligation to do that, because New York state law says that if a parent is deemed to be so mentally ill that they sort of think they can't parent, no help is needed. And then in many other states, what ends up happening is that there might be some help, but that help isn't targeted in the right way to help parents with the real struggles that they have because of this psychiatric disability. You know, there are some advocates who argue that this is a disability rights issue, that really these parents ought to have access to accommodating kinds of services and programs that they need to help them raise their kids.
As you point out in the story, and this is, I think, this other fascinating thing I was just thinking about, is this gets really at our concept as a society of our understanding of mental illness. You point out in the story there are 30 states with laws that allow this kind of thing. A lot of these laws have kind of were originally based on really a very different conception than the latest understanding of what mental illness is and the ability to moderate it and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of these laws were written during a time when many mental health professionals and society at large sort of believed that serious mental illness discounted people from participation in a whole set of normal parts of life, including being a parent. And in fact, you know, for a long time, people who had serious mental illness, then often called feeble-minded, were institutionalized and in some states legally sterilized. We've collectively sort of changed the way that we think, both the science and the sort of culture around mental health, to understand that people can recover, that they can be treated and recover and function as part of communities. But these laws sort of hang on to this idea that mental illness can really discount some people from that basic part of life, parenting. And so there's, I think, a strong argument that the way that the laws are written and certainly in the way that they are implemented, they are antiquated.
And you know, one of the things just in terms of to flesh out the idea of how they're implemented, one of the things that you focus on is this question of, well, you know, how do you test if somebody is a capable parent? And the shortcomings and ultimately kind of biases that come up in the way that it's done in many states.
Yeah, a lot of mental health professionals, psychologists and psychiatrists, including some fairly prominent academic researchers on the issues of parents with mental health, have said a couple of things. You know, the first thing they say is there's nothing that can prove this person is just not going to be able to parent. Yet these tests, so they're psychological tests to test symptoms or IQ tests or other measures, are often used to really determine whether somebody should be allowed to take their children home with them, to raise their children. One of the things that I found was often the case, and academic research of psychological evaluations in these cases has shown, is that the evaluators, these psychologists, regularly fail to reach out to the relatives and community members of these parents to say, will you be there for those kids, to figure out who will be there to help support those families. I write about this man named Rudy, who is asking to be allowed to raise his daughter with the help of his sister, who happened to be a psychiatric nurse at a hospital, and their mother, who would all raise this little girl together. But the evaluator that was appointed by the court to evaluate Rudy's mental health basically evaluated him on the basis of a series of interviews and tests and a review of his mental health records without ever really reaching out to those people in his life that are going to be or would be essential to raising this little girl.
And one of the interesting things there is this, you know, as you point out, the question of it's not just a question of support that, you know, that the parents might be able to get via family members, but this real sort of funny dynamic between you have psychiatrists and psychologists who are doing the evaluations, often doing it in this very narrow way, not just looking at questions of support, but just the kind of, you know, looking at primarily tests and primarily ultimately the diagnoses rather than a kind of holistic view of, well, how are they actually doing parenting?
Right. I mean, many people said to me, nobody raises their kids alone. And this was a refrain, right, from parents, from attorneys, and from psychological professionals who would say, you know, no, think about anybody who's successfully raising a kid. They're not doing it alone. They're doing it with help. And I think what ends up happening is that many evaluators think that their role is to just look at this person as if they exist in isolation from the rest of their life. And the truth is that very rarely is that the case. That's certainly not the case for most of these people. And that sort of broader, more holistic view of what it means to be a parent really isn't part of that evaluation process.
And you were talking about the case of Rudy, who we profile in the story, and who got these quite narrow evaluation ultimately about his diagnosis. And, you know, it's an interesting case there because he is a person who has significant, you know, mental health issues. And there's this sort of natural question of this isn't an easy case. But do you want to sort of talk about one of the interesting things there is that while it's not an easy case, he acknowledges that and in fact hasn't been proposing to raise his child alone.
That's right. Rudy has had two evaluations, and the evaluator appointed by the court basically found that his mental illness made him unfit to parent. The other evaluator, somebody
The first evaluator, mostly looking at doing psychiatric tests, looking at his mental health records, and kind of narrowly focused on his diagnosis.
That's right. And so this narrow study of this father really wasn't able to see the larger picture. Rudy and his attorneys hired another evaluator, a pretty well-respected academic psychologist in New York, who did a different review of Rudy and talked to Rudy's sister and some caseworkers that Rudy had been in touch with earlier in his life. And Rudy's somebody who actually is planning quite properly for his daughter in that he's reached out to his family members to say, will you help me? I mean, his analysis is, yeah, this man might have trouble raising his daughter by himself, but that's not what he's asking to do. And in fact, Rudy has said repeatedly, you know, it's hard to raise a kid alone.
He's planning to raise his kid, I'm sorry, with his sister and mother.
He's planning to raise his kid to move in with his sister and where his mother will also live, and they'll raise this little girl together at this point. And, you know, child welfare officials sort of said, well, it's too little, too late. Sorry, your kid has been in foster care too long. He says, you know, nobody ever tried to help me get my daughter back. He thought that his daughter would end up living with the daughter's mother, but she really sort of bailed on the case and stopped showing up for court. And then the county filed with a court to terminate his parental rights, based now largely on the content of that first very narrow evaluation of his mental health.
And then we asked, you asked, and it was a great idea, might I say, to have a third evaluator expert essentially just look at the two different evaluations and just to talk about the methods that they used and any shortcomings.
That's right. So I asked an academic psychologist and researcher who also does evaluations himself, and he specializes in evaluating parents who have mental disabilities, people like Rudy. And he read these two evaluations really to look at the soundness of their methods. And what he found was that the first evaluator, the evaluator appointed by the court, measured Rudy's mental health in a way that was far too narrow to make much sense. As one other person sort of described it, that the evaluation started to speak louder than Rudy's real life, than the real life he was proposing to live with his daughter along with his sister. The professor I asked to review the evaluations, you know, he said the first evaluator, the court's evaluator, it wasn't that it was a terrible evaluation, that it, in fact, it was a pretty rigorous evaluation compared to many, but it really lacked any sort of broader view of Rudy's life. And this professor then read the other evaluation, the evaluation that was conducted by the psychologist that Rudy hired, and said, you know, this man took that extra step of calling Rudy's sister, calling the caseworkers, and really trying to draw a picture of this man as a full person in the life he would actually live.
And so what do you think, after having spent many months reporting the story and digging into it, how do you think that, frankly, we as a society could deal with this better?
Well, I think that child welfare systems are often systems that in many ways lack the kind of support that they need, the resources that they need. And, you know, there's lots of child welfare cases that struggle to provide families with what they need. But these are cases where that's absolutely the case. And rather than sort of treat mental illness as this scary thing that we've decided, you know, certain people are going to be removed from the right to parent, going to be excluded from the right to parent, rather than moving in the direction that I think we often move in, to really provide deep supports to families. Sometimes that may mean things like supported housing where people are living in communities. Sometimes that could look like intensive mental health care for both parents and children. There's lots of things that could be done, I think, to support families. And there are some models of that in various places around the country. But by and large, I think the response from child welfare departments is often either to try to deny services entirely or treat these families like they're every other family and not really take account of the needs that those parents have because of their psychiatric disabilities.
Thank you for doing this. And it's a great story.
Thanks a lot, Eric.